cases, even some relatives. And if we're just running a few minutes late, I apologize. I was standing in Belfer Hall waiting to give the men's cheer before someone figured out that I was in the wrong building. So I apologize. I also apologize that I'll probably have to be running from here because then I have to go to Belfer Hall to give the men's cheer. But it is my pleasure to be here and to share some words of Torah with you this morning. The truth is that even though I spent 10 years on YU campus, they didn't come up with the brilliant idea of Midrash Yom Rishon until after I was already living in Baltimore. So I've been a fan from afar until now. Now I live in Eretz Yisrael, but when the opportunity presented itself to return to the States for some speaking, I was happy that it was able to be arranged that I could join this very wonderful program. And really, great yishar koach to YU for initiating it, and especially for you for participating in it. Not to remind you of something too scary, but Pesach is in 2 weeks. And the fact that we have a nice full room of women here to learn Torah on a Sunday morning is truly a remarkable testament to you. I wanted to speak about a topic this morning which is, as we'll show, clearly related to Chag HaPesach, but I deliberately chose a topic which was not exclusively related to Pesach, but through studying the sources as they initially relate to Chag HaPesach and the story of the Jewish journey in Mitzrayim, I think we'll then be able to, time permitting, broaden the discussion and see the general and more wider implications of the topic at hand. I think that most of us, and I include myself, when we were younger, perhaps even as we've gotten older, in our studies and in various shiurim, we've probably heard or read somewhere where someone quoted an idea that despite all of the manifold averos that the Jewish people did while they were in Mitzrayim and the tradition that they were on the lowest level of Tumah, etc., but yet, nevertheless, besides God's kindness in redeeming us, that we did have some merits. And often, the way the Medrash or the teaching of Chazal is quoted and attributed is that there were a number of merits that the Jewish people had. And in particular, I remember hearing this many times, especially when I was younger, it was that Shelo Shinu et Shemam, they didn't change their names. Lo Shinu et Lashonam, they didn't change their language. Velo Shinu et Malbusham, they didn't change their clothing. Anyone else ever hear such a medrash? You have heard it, right? Okay, so I'm here to tell you that it doesn't exist. Unfortunately, the rest of the shiur won't be as exciting. But that's my bombshell. I'm leading with the bombshell. The Medrash does not exist. That was not my find or my insight. It was actually the discovery, if you will, of the great encyclopedic Talmud Chacham Rav Menachem Mendel Kasher, Zichrono Livracha, who was the author and editor of the great encyclopedic work, Torah Shlema. Now, I'm overstating it a little bit, for effect, of course, but not entirely. And I want to start by studying Chazal's understanding of how the Jewish people were able to fashion and maintain an identity while they were in Mitzrayim, and we will see that it is not as simple as we might have once believed. And then I would like, as I said, to broaden that discussion to discuss the issue which I really believe confronts all of us. I would say especially those living in Chutz Laretz, but things aren't automatic or easy if you live in Eretz Yisrael either, and that is the way we try to maintain for ourselves and especially for our children a sense of healthy and unique and separate Jewish identity, and at the same time not being completely removed or isolated from the wider society around us. And I think we all understand implicitly that one of the areas in which that balance needs to be struck, not the only, but one of the critical areas, is in fact how we dress either sends a message that we're a part of somebody or often sends a message that we're apart from them. And that balance, which, as we all know, different parts of the Orthodox community strike that balance in different ways, I'd like to see if we can understand where that's all coming from. But let's start with Pesach, and let's start with Mitzrayim. If you take a look at your source sheets, in the opening source, we have two Midrashim. It's actually two Midrashim out of many that I could have given you. Two Midrashim that do speak about the Jewish merit of being redeemed from Egypt, but with the introduction that I've already given you, you certainly will be sensitive not only to what the Medrash does say, but what the Medrash does not say. So for example, in Vayikra Rabbah in source number 1, the Medrash tells us that why were the Jews redeemed? For 4 reasons. Number one, Shaloshinu et Shimon. They didn't change their names. Even with all the things that were going on, the Medrash says Reuven was still Reuven and Shimon was still Shimon. Lo Shinu es Lashonam. Apparently they spoke some sort of Lashon HaKodesh even throughout the time that they were in Egypt. They never assimilated their language. And then the Medrash adds two more things. They didn't speak Lashon Hara, perhaps the most impressive thing. They could avoid Lashon Hara. And Shaloya Behen Paratz Erva. There wasn't sexual licentiousness or immorality. So those are interesting. What's really striking, of course, is that Lashon Hara and immorality are real bona fide halachos. It's not clear what halacha there is to speak Hebrew or what halacha there is to have a Jewish name, and yet the Medrash does seem to equate them. But as I said, the one thing that's prominent here is not what is mentioned, but what is not. There is nothing in the Medrash about clothing. It doesn't exist. It's not true. Take a look at source number two from Bamidbar Rabbah. We find a similar phenomenon. Four things that the Jewish people merited to be saved. Shelo Shinu et Shemotam, they didn't say change their names. Lo Shinu et Lashonam, again, we have that phenomenon. Those two are always there. Velo Gilu Mistorin Shelehem. Anyone know what the word Mistorin means? Mystery. What was the mystery? The mystery was that at an early stage, when Moshe first told the Jewish people he would take them out, he let them know that when you go out, you're going to be taking lots of gold, lots of silver, lots of stuff. And even though they didn't go out for over a year, said Chazal, giving them credit, they were able to keep that secret. Could you imagine if someone told you you're going to win the lottery in a year, and you were able not to tell any of your friends for a whole year? That's a hard thing to do. Now, why that's so important, not the topic of our shir, but that's the third thing, that, at least in this medrash. And then the fourth thing again is repeated, lo nifritzu ba'arayos. Again, they were sexually modest. So the one change is Lashon Hara, or this secret, which is a little bit like Lashon Hara, although not the same thing. But prominent in its absence is in both cases, this formula, which we're familiar with, the Shaloshinu formula, actually does mention language and does mention names, but never mentions anything about clothing. And Rav Kasher points this out, and Rav Kasher points out that it seems clear that that medrash, which we're often referred to, either never existed, or at least it's no longer extant. We have no manuscripts anywhere. Now, with all the research and discoveries and digital databases, there's no manuscripts ever that's ever been found, at least that are extant, which have that triple, that multiple of Loshinu, Lashonam, Shmam, and Malbusham. Clothing is not mentioned. Now that itself, when I first realized this last year, to me was a bombshell discovery. But, you know, life is never too exciting. And the truth is, if you continue reading, and I give Rav Kasher the credit, he's the one who mined these initial sources, Rav Kasher points out that there are other midrashim, which while not part of this famous Shaloshinu formula, but there are some much more esoteric, not nearly as well known, sources that do mention the issue of fashion. We have to be honest about that. And that's sources 3 and 4. The Psikta Zutraso, otherwise known as the Medrash Lekach Tov, again, not nearly as prominent as the Medrash Rabbah, but a bona fide source in Chazal. So there, the Medrash also speaks about four things. And there, the term that's used is Velo Chilfu Es Simlosam. Or in source number 4, Shehaya Malbusham, and their food, and their Lashonam, etc., Mishunim Min HaMitzriyim. So we do have two lesser known Midrashim, again, to be full and on the record, we do have two Midrashim that do mention the issue of fashion. And I think that, on the one hand, it's important to acknowledge that, but I don't think it's a small thing, at least it wasn't for me personally in my own learning, to have that awareness that, number one, those Midrashim are not nearly as well known or as prominent, and number two is, the famous ones that we're familiar with, the Loshinu ones, in fact, never mention it. So not to say that it's not true or that it's not important, but it's clearly not as prominent and it's clearly not as mainstream or necessarily effective. There is one prominent authority, the one Rishon, the Ritva, whose name you may be familiar with, mostly because there's a famous commentary on the Gemara and a halachist, but the Ritva has a commentary on the Haggadah as well. And the Ritva there also mentions this idea of keeping separate from clothing. Although I will note in source number 5 that before he gets to that, it's not really the topic of the shir, but it's so important I can't resist sharing it with you. I hope you'll appreciate it as well. In the second line of source number 5, the Ritva focuses on something much more substantial. Vaday neis me Hashem yizbarach kedei sheyu ozrim ze laze ki hapirud sivar hagalos. V'af bagalos hazeh achamor hapirud haya ikar gzeres hagalos. Says the Ritva, what's so important about this idea of Jewish identity? So we think of it more of what it's not. It keeps us away from assimilating with the non-Jewish culture. It's amazing that we would have been tempted to assimilate with a non-Jewish culture that was enslaving and tormenting us. But it's kind of a Stockholm syndrome, I guess. If you're there long enough, you would have been tempted to adapt and to identify. But here the Ritva says what's important about the fact that they had their own separate identity wasn't that they weren't becoming assimilated to Egyptians. It was that they were reminding themselves of their connection with each other. And that the Golos, why are they down in Mitzrayim? Because of the period of the Machlokes between Yosef and his brothers. And therefore, he says, the only way they would ultimately be redeemed is if they would do chesed with each other and realize that they're really one family and one nation. And the idea of identity, it wasn't a sur meira, it wasn't to keep them away from something bad as much as it was, says the Ritva, to bring them close to each other so they can then in a positive asay tov manner realize that it's all unzara, we're all together, we're all family and help each other. And I think that's really a subtle but important and striking difference. The rest of our shir will really be more focusing on the other half, the idea of how we relate to the non-Jewish world and issues of identity. But the Ritva, even though he does mention this idea as an important one, he doesn't take it in the usual direction that we expect or the way it's often quoted. Rather, he uses it in a more positive way of Jews maintaining a connection to each other. Source number 6, which is the Haggadah of the Abar Benel, the Zevach Pesach. Also, just again to be clear, he doesn't quote a source. We can imagine what his source is now, even though we know it's not so clear. But he also mentions the idea of clothing. Now, I want to move off of that medrash in particular and share with you something that is really quite striking. And this will be kind of our last focus on Pesach and Mitzrayim for a moment before we start broadening the discussion. But this is a remarkable statement of the Meshech Chachma. In source number 7, Rav Meir Simcha of Dvinsk has an amazing, amazing insight. And he also points out how important it is that the Jews maintain their identity while they were in Egypt. And he focuses in the way that we're much more familiar with the idea of identity being a way of preserve or separateness, being able to preserve identity and maintain who we are even in a long galus. But what's remarkable and what's original about the Meshech Chachma is that he attributes this insight and this strategy not to something that naturally evolved to the Jews while they were in Galus, and not to something that happened when they were really confronted. He attributes it way in advance to Yaakov Avinu. That Yaakov Avinu had a kind of a Ruach HaKodesh, he had a sense of where things were going for the people. And again, we know that Yaakov himself did go down into Egypt, but when Yaakov was still alive, that was a golden Galus, if you will. Yosef was there, they had separate identity, yeshivas, kolim, they were living it up in Goshen. It wasn't like being in Eretz Canaan, perhaps, but it wasn't the type of assimilation and plumbing to the depths of, you know, religious almost oblivion, which eventually happened. And yet, even in the, quote, good times, Yaakov understood that this was a long road, and that he understood that in order to survive that long road, they needed to think proactively, right? So how often, in general, and especially in Jewish life, you know, the constant lament, sometimes it's a criticism, but the lament is how everything is too reactive. And the leaders and the universities and the yeshivas and everyone, everyone's reacting instead of leading, they're being proactive. Well, Yaakov was a true leader, he was proactive. And the Meshech Chachma says that how did he do this? So if you take a look where it's underlined, he says, Chashva ofanim v'tachpulot. Yaakov had to come up with all sorts of tricks, if you will, all sorts of strategies, all sorts of great creative ideas, Asher Yisrael Yitkaimu L'goy V'lo Yitpalalu Ba'amim, to make sure that they would, despite the 200 plus years that they would be in Egypt, that they wouldn't lose their identity, that they would remain a Jewish people. V'heira Alzeh G'dolei Ha'uma La'asos B'zeh G'darim U'siyagim. And therefore Yaakov Avinu, first but not last among our leaders, realized we have to put certain things in place, Asher Ha'uma Titkayim B'sh'on Galei Hayam, so that we can, he's writing very poetically, you know, there's a stormy sea out there, and if we want to be able to hang on for dear life, We have to think proactively. We can't drown the mesulos hasar shotef baruach amitz v'kavir. In order to remain alive and spiritually identified in the sea of golos, says the Meshech Chachma, Yaakov Avinu understood that certain strategy has to be put in place. And therefore he says in the last underlined section, Choshev tachbula v'etza asher banav yiyu mitzuyanim sham v'bigdehem u'b'shimosam. So he says Yaakov Avinu was the one who had this idea. Keep your Jewish name and dress in a way that's different than everybody else. Now he doesn't say what that was, but the idea was that apparently you could be identified as a Jew by the way you dressed. In more recent history, 60 years ago, we think of that identifying mark as a very negative and scary thing. And when people do it to us, it is a scary and negative thing. But here he's speaking about something more positive and organic. It's coming from within the Jewish people. A way of saying, you know what, we can't be completely a part of, we have to be a little bit at least apart from, because or else we're going to lose our identity. L'chein hayu Yisrael l'goy b'fnei atzmo. Without this, says the Meshech Chachma, we would not have been able to survive. This notion, more broadly now, we can leave the Mitzrayim story for further discussion and reflection, but let's, if you will, broaden the discussion now. Clearly these Makoros are raising an important issue. And let's be honest, it's a perennial issue. Is the issue of Jewish identity and how we fit in a host culture any different now than it was then? We're not enslaved, Baruch Hashem. But perhaps that makes the issues even more acute. It is striking. It's hard to believe that a Jew would have forgotten he was a Jew in Mitzrayim if he just dressed a little differently. You would think that the taskmasters would have reminded them plenty good that they were Jewish. So if Yaakov and Chazal see some sense of needing to preserve a Jewish identity even then, how much more so when we're in a host environment that, to borrow a phrase, sometimes loves us to death? So clearly this is a balancing act. At the same time, starting with me, the only man in the room, and you forgive me, but I'm looking out, I don't see anyone who's dressed in any way that couldn't be anyone else of the hundreds of millions of Americans here. I guess the hair covering is a little bit uniquely Jewish, but certainly I don't look any different, you know, than like maybe a, I don't know if I look like a banker maybe, but maybe a mid-level something, I don't know. I don't look like an Israeli rabbi, that's for sure. I'm dressed in an American-style thing. I think this is from Brooks Brothers, and you know, my father got me a tie as a present. You know, very American. So, you know, is this something that we need to think about? How we dress? And I'm not now discussing at all the issue of tznius, although we'll maybe mention it briefly at the end. I'm talking about identity. Who are we? So, if they were worried about it in Egypt, and they felt that the clothing was a factor, maybe we need to think about this as well. There are some more machshava sources, if you will, but I want to skip them in the purpose of time. And I want to use now the next big chunk of the remainder of the shir to focus on the halachic question. At the end of the day, the discussion about Mitzrayim and these sources are all nice, and they're chumash sources, and they're medrash sources. But we don't typically paskin shailas. We don't necessarily make decisions in our life thousands of years later, just based on Midrashim, especially when we've now seen that the Midrashim are not necessarily so monolithic, even in their approach to the issue of fashion. But there is a halachic discussion. And that is something which, if we're going to be serious Jews, if we're going to take not only our identity, but our commitment seriously, so obviously we need to see this a little bit in a halachic frame of reference. What I'm referring to is a discussion which begins in source number 10 and 11, and then gets deepened throughout the generations, and that is the topic of Chukos Ha'akum. The Torah says in Vayikra and Perek Yud Chet, in source number 10, that we have to separate ourselves from host cultures. It's not surprising that the opening example in the Parsha, in the Pasuk, is Mitzrayim. But then the Torah itself broadens the discussion, says in general, whenever you're in external cultures, U'b'chukotehem lo teleichu. We're not allowed to go in the ways of the non-Jews. Well, what does that mean? A non-Jew drives a car. I can't drive a car. His house has a slanted roof. I can't have a slanted roof. You know, in Israel, very often you can tell what neighborhood you're in by the roofs. To this day, most Arab homes have flat roofs. So I can't make a flat roof if I like that. That's b'chukotehem. Without knowing any sources, we already have an instinct, we have a gut reaction, and we look around at the Jewish world, we know clearly it can't be that black and white. There are plenty of things that even the most separated, if you will, of Jews do, which seem to be very similar to everybody else. So clearly, even though this pasuk seems to be very broad in sweep and scope, clearly we need to refine a little bit what that means. What are the chukos? We have a hard time enough understanding what the chok is in the Torah, paraduma and the like. But what are the chukim of the goyim, of the non-Jews, that the Torah is telling us those we have to avoid? And as typical, that's not so clear from the pasuk. For this, we need to turn to the Torah Sheba'al Peh. And there are two classic gemaras, one in Masechet Avodah Zarah and one in Masechet Sanhedrin, to try to deal with this question. And as we'll see in a moment, they're dealing with a very specific Shiloh, which is not at all relevant to us anymore. But please keep your eye out, pay attention to not the specific examples of the Gemara, but the wider principle that the Gemara is grappling with. Because you'll see it's very clear the Gemara is grappling exactly with this issue, which, while the examples will be dated, as you'll see in a moment, the issue that the Gemara is grappling with is just as relevant today as it was then. The Gemara, if you'll take a look both in source number 11 and in 12, starts off with a discussion about a custom that used to have that the Jewish kings, the monarchy, the malachim, when they would die, the Mishnah says that the Jews would gather together and they would burn their property, burn their clothing and the like. Why did they do this? It wasn't Baal Tashchis. This was an idea, a tribute to the king. No one's going to wear the king's suits. No one's going to wear the king's robes. Certain things which were unique, the scepter of the monarch, those could never be used by anybody else. And it was considered a form of tribute to burn them. However, the Gemara says that this was something that at the time, the other non-Jewish countries, they did the same thing for their kings. If a non-Jewish king, if the Amori king, if the Plishti king, if the Canaanite king died, they burned his clothing. And Lahavdil, when David HaMelech or Shlomo HaMelech died, they burned his clothing. So the Gemara asked the question, well, isn't that a violation of B'chukoteyam Lo Telechu? I thought the Torah told us we can't imitate and follow the non-Jewish ways. So the Gemara has one answer in source number 11. The Gemara says, Ella, the Kule Alma Sreifa Lab Chukahi, Ella Chashivusa Hi. It's not a violation of a chok of the non-Jews. What does that mean? What the Gemara seems to be getting at is just like when we speak about Shatnez or Para Aduma, things which we don't really understand. We accept because they're in the Torah, but they're a chok. We don't really understand them. Similarly, when it comes to trying to draw the line, which things in the non-Jewish culture are we supposed to avoid? So the Gemara here seems to be saying, well, it depends. If it's something that doesn't really make any obvious sense, it's just the kind of thing that evolves in a certain culture, and there's no obvious good reason for it, then a Jew should stay away from it. But here, in the case of the burning of the clothing, again, it sounds foreign to our modern ears. But if we can put ourselves back in a more medieval and monarchical society, says the Gemara, Chashivutahi. That was being done for a very good, eminently reasonable reason. It's done to show the chashivus, the importance of the king. So the fact that a non-Jew has a good idea doesn't mean that we're not allowed to have the same good idea, even if we got the idea from them. But if we think about it, it makes sense to us, chashivus, it makes sense, that we can do it too. A chukah, something which would make no sense, that we shouldn't do. But something that makes sense, chashivus, that we're allowed to do. So that's one possible way of drawing the line. We have to look at things. Things which look more arbitrary, a little bit more counterintuitive, maybe those we should stay away from. But things which really make eminently good sense, they seem to be reasonable. So the fact that someone beat us to the punch and thought of the idea before us doesn't mean that we have to avoid reasonable, logical, helpful things. That's the first principle of the Gemara. However, a little bit more of a restrictive, more machmir approach comes from the second Gemara. That's in source number 12, the Gemara in Sanhedrin. Here the Gemara eventually makes its way to the king in the burning of the clothing, but just in case that's not foreign enough for our culture, starts with a more basic machlokes in the Mishnah there, which has to do with a death penalty. When Sanhedrin used to give out a death penalty, we know there were four ways of inflicting that punishment on someone who was deserved and proven in the Sanhedrin that they were guilty. One of them is saif. Saif means taking a sword and cutting someone's head off. So the Gemara, and you'll forgive me, I should have warned those who already are having a little breakfast, I'll try not to be overly graphic, but the Gemara, or the Mishnah really has a debate. How did they inflict this punishment? So one opinion was more like a guillotine, and the other one was basically where, if you can imagine, to use a more contemporary reference, a baseball player, but not a bat, but a sword, and the victim is kind of standing up, and you get the idea. So the Mishnah quotes these two opinions. And the Mishnah says that one of them, the one that seems to be more like the guillotine, that's a nivul, that's so degrading. Now, I have to admit, for years, I've never been able to figure out why one of those is worse than the other. They both seem to be pretty bit degrading, and that kind of sounds like part of the point. But yet, in the Mishnah, sensitivities, which I admit I don't really have, I can't really appreciate, the Mishnah sees a subtle difference between these two things, and asks on one of the opinions, how could you do that? That's too manuval. We know, really, to be fair, in other sources, even when we have a capital punishment, we still try as much as possible to preserve the dignity of the one who's going to get punished. So if this way of giving the death penalty is so severe, it's so degrading, shouldn't that be a problem? So the Gemara, when it answers that, the Gemara says, well, you're right, I agree with you, it's very degrading. But what can I do? The guillotine is not a Jewish idea. I can't go with your approach, because that's already being done by the non-Jews. And therefore, when the Jews have to give their own death penalty, they needed to come up with a different way. So using that, which is again a similar discussion, the Gemara says, well, one second, let's borrow from a discussion we already know about, the issue of burning the king's clothing. And here the Gemara repeats the same discussion that we already saw, but with one major difference. The punchline changes. And if you look at the bottom of source number 12, the Gemara says, commenting now that it's transitioned back to the issue of the king and his clothing, what's the issue? Why are we allowed to burn the king's clothing? So what would you expect, based on what we saw previously? What's going to be the answer? Why are you allowed to burn the king's clothing? Chashivutahi, it makes sense. It's a way of tributing to the king. But here the Gemara says no. Look at the last line. It quotes a pasuk from the Navi Yirmiyah, which is considered a source, an authentic Jewish, a biblical source for the idea of burning the clothing. It says, therefore, because we have that pasuk, lav minayu kagamrinan, we're not learning it from them. It may be that they were doing it before us in a current time and place. But if we can locate, says the Gemara, some traditional, authentic Jewish source, if we can find some makor, Tanakh, and in our case, maybe a Gemara even might count, but in the Gemara, they needed to go earlier. They're looking for a source in Tanakh. If we can find a source that authenticates this as a Jewish practice, so then we can, if you will, hang our hat on that source, and then we could say we're actually not getting it from them. It's really a Jewish idea. It has its basis, at least its roots, however subtle, in our own tradition. Now, if you think about this for a moment, this is not just a different answer, it's a very different answer. And the implications of this answer are radical. Which of these two Gemaras would be much more restrictive, much more machmir in how we would apply this to things that are a lot more familiar to us than burning king's clothing and cutting people's heads off? Which one is more machmir and more restrictive? The second one, right? In the first one, we use one litmus test, common sense. Now, as the old joke goes, common sense ain't so common, and we could then have an argument, which we're very good at doing, that's an authentically Jewish tradition. We can have a big argument about what is considered a good idea and a bad idea. Right? One big shul board meeting for every issue. But leave how we'll figure that out aside. That's an important but technical point. We know as long as something makes sense, it's a good idea, then even if it's totally being borrowed from the non-Jews, it's allowed. They have good ideas too. The second Gemara is much more restrictive, much more of a particularistic approach. Jews do what Jews do, period. If they happen to be doing something that we're doing, so we're not going to punish ourselves. but only if, according to the second Gemara, we can identify an authentic Jewish source and say, this is a Jewish way of doing things. After all, you know, there's some Tanakh expert we asked, and, you know, nowadays, of course, if we were looking for a pasuk in Tanakh, who would we have to ask? Women. I'd have to come to the Midrash of Yom Rishon. The men don't know anything about Tanakh. But we'd find some very knowledgeable woman who would tell me, a typical yeshiva bacher, about a pasuk in Tanakh, and we would say, okay, this is allowed, it has an authentic Jewish source. But if we couldn't, if there was no source, it would seem to be prohibited. So this is not just two different Gemaras. The consequences and implications of this machlokas are clearly far-ranging. And the real question, of course, is, how do we paskin? This is, like, really important. It affects almost everything. How do we paskin? So here, of course, there's a machlokas. But, since we don't have time to go through the whole machlokas, let's focus specifically on what seems to be the predominant view, the view that really gets cited in the Shulchan Aruch. And it's really a combination of two sources. One which is more general, and one, interestingly enough, which relates specifically to the issue of fashion. And that is two sources in number 13 and 14, the Ran, Rabbeinu Nisim, and the Maharik, Yosef Cologne, who was actually one of the great Italian Rishonim. So the Ran in source number 13 explains as follows. You know what's prohibited? Only things, Elu Dvarim Shel Hebel Ubatala. Only things which make no sense, which are just a waste of time. Now stop for one moment, put your thinking caps on. Which Gemara is the Ran working with? Which Gemara is the Ran accepting as predominant and determinative? Clearly the first Gemara. Whew. First Gemara. If it makes sense, says the Ran, apparently it's okay, but if it's Tvar Mishal Hevel Batala, it makes no sense, then we shouldn't do it. Now here's an important second question. Well, what's so bad about doing things that make no sense? This is essentially the back and forth I have with my 12-year-old son every day. Because I'll ask him to do something specifically like clean up his room, which in his mind makes no sense. And I'll say, because it's dirty. And he'll say, but what's so bad about that? So, I haven't come up with a really good answer, by the way. I'm just doing what my parents did to me. But he's still making clean up his room. But in his mind, it makes no sense. But what's so bad about doing something that makes no sense? So what's so bad about doing something that's a davar shel hevel or batala? So the Ran says something fascinating. V'kulan yesh behem sorech avodas kochavim. You know why? Because nothing makes no sense. Nothing has no rationale. It may not be obvious to you. It may not be evident to you what the rationale is. But there's a reason. And if there's no obvious reason, we have to suspect that maybe it has its origins, its roots in paganism, in Avodah Zarah. Maybe even the non-Jews don't remember. And we're not saying, the Ran is not saying that you're going to do it for that reason. You may not be aware of it either. But somebody has no reason, choshesh, be worried that maybe it's because of Avodah Zarah. The only example I could think of in modern times, which as far as I once asked somebody, and this is what they told me, might be the reason, is when you're making a l'chaim with someone, on Diet Coke, you shouldn't make l'chaims on anything else. But if you're making a l'chaim with somebody, and what do people do with the two glasses? Clink. Cheers. Now, it doesn't really make any sense. That is a classic Dover Shel Hevel Ubatala. So somebody once told me that the origins of that are paganistic. That they did that clink was to scare away the spirits. You can Google it, I guess, and Wikipedia it. But that's what I was told by somebody. If that's true, so then I would submit that would be a classic example of what the Ran was worried about. It makes no sense, but we do things without thinking, because that's what we always do. We do many things without thinking about them. So says the Ran, if it doesn't make any sense, be choshesh, maybe it has a bad origin. That's the opinion of Rabbeinu Nisim. However, if you take a look at source number 14, the Maharik says something almost the same, but a little different. He was asked a very, very practical question. Apparently, in his day, at least in Italy, is when they came up with the Einfalt, with the great idea that doctors should be identifiable by their clothing. And the shaila that was asked to him, and this is an interesting side topic, not our topic at all for today, many, many from Jews in Italy, in particular Rabban, and many of the Gedolei Italy, were doctors, medical doctors. More so, as far as I'm aware, than in almost any other country in our history. Wadafka in Italy was very, very common. So the Maharik was asked by religious doctors, look at the first two words of source number 14. Al-dober ha-kappa. That's a cape. So I don't know if it was a white coat the way we have it. I don't know what color it was, he doesn't say. But they had a doctor's coat. The classic doctor's coat. So did you ever think that was a shaila? They thought so in Italy at the time. They asked the Maharik, all these Jewish doctors, are we allowed to start wearing this non-Jewish invention, if you will, this doctor's cape? That was his question. Fascinating. So in the end, he says 100% it's mutter. Totally mutter. And he explains because this prohibition of chukos akum has to take one of two forms. Either, he says, something that's not sanua, and it's important to note, he's not talking exclusively to women at all here. There could be not sanua for men as well. But something that's not sanua, he says, is by definition un-Jewish. This is a profound point, which we're not going to dwell on, but it's worth thinking about. To be un-sanua, he says, is profoundly non-Jewish. To be Jewish is to be sanua. Jewish clothing, by definition, has to be sanua. So if you're not sanua, you have two problems. One is you're not sanua, and one is that's already a non-Jewish thing. But that doesn't relate to the cape. How does he help you? What's the issue with the cape? It's serving a purpose, right? People know who the doctor is. They know who to call. They know who to run to. So he says in the end, it's totally permissible. Why? Because only things which make no sense are prohibited. If you take a look about five lines down, the first thing he says is that davar she'ein bo tam nigla, kaven shu osa davar mishuna she'ein bo tam nigla. You're doing something weird which doesn't make any sense. It seems to be totally arbitrary, not so logical. You can't do that. That's prohibited. Now, who does that remind us of? It reminds us of the previous source, the Ran. The Ran says things which make no sense, things which seem to be arbitrary, you shouldn't do. But whereas the Ran said, therefore, what are we worried about? If it makes no sense, your antenna should be up. What are we worried about? If it doesn't make any sense, what should we worry about? Avodah Zarah. See, he, the Maharik, says something slightly different, I think really interesting. If you do something that makes no sense, I'm reading here five lines down in the middle of the line, why are you doing it then? I mean, who wants to admit that they do things that make no sense? Not me, not you. So why are you doing it then? Ela sheheim nogin kein az nira vadai k'nimshech acharehem umodelehem. Why do we do things that the non-Jews around us do if they make no obvious sense? One reason. Because we want to imitate them. We want to be like the Goyim. So we want to dress like them, we want to talk like them, we want to act like them, because we want to be like them. That alone, says the Maharik, is the problem. Period. Nothing to do with Avodah Zarah and, you know, being neurotic about maybe there's some non-Jewish reason. Avodah Zarah reason. Just the mentality. So you put on a, you know, shirt and pants, so you gotta be dressed. They're comfortable, they're practical. You're not doing that per se, just to imitate people around you. But other things, and I'm not gonna give examples because I want to get out of here without getting in trouble. But we have to think about it, honestly, each one of us. Many other things which don't really seem to make compelling sense. If you think about it, why are we doing them? Because we want to be like them. I'll give you one example because I can speak personally. I'm guilty. When I was, I think it was either in fourth or fifth grade, is when Nike decided to come up with their first genius marketing ploy, make sneakers and put Michael Jordan's name on them. And I was convinced, I mean, I could have taken a Shavua de Oraisa, that if I got those sneakers, I was going to be in the NBA. I'm a firstborn and an only son. And I can't say my parents completely spoiled me, but they gave me a lot of things that I asked for. And one of them was those sneakers. I was so happy with those sneakers. Now, do you remember what the jingo, what the Nike tagline, the advertising was for these sneakers? They had a song, which even if my voice wasn't hoarse, I don't want to sing because I'm not a good singer. But the words were, I want to be, I want to be, I want to be like Mike. The whole reason to get the sneakers is because you want to be like Michael Jordan. I wanted to be like Michael Jordan. It's the first but not last of the disappointments in my life. So, in a serious way, in an adult way, says the Maharik, that's the Isser. That is the Isser. doing things just because you want to be like them. I had a friend when I was probably about the same age who was copying everything I did. It was making me nuts. So my parents came to me and said, you know, you have to understand, he's just doing this because he likes you. And that was when they taught me, as a young kid, that imitation is the highest form of flattery. Says the Ma'arik, that's the point. When we do things just because we want to be like them, not because we happen to be doing, not because they make sense, but because we're doing it because we want to be like them. So-and-so movie star is wearing that dress, so I have to wear that dress. This one has that purse, I have to have that purse, etc., etc. Not because you really went to the store and, ooh, that's pretty, I like that. Nothing wrong with that. But when you're doing it just to be like them, that itself, imitation, is the highest form of flattery. If you take a look at source number 16, this is a tshuva of Rabbi Yehuda Herzl Henkin. I'm sure you've heard of him, the husband of Rabbanit Henkin. So in his tshuvas, in source number 16, he just mentions as a footnote, a letter of the Chazon Ish. And I was very taken by this formulation of the Chazon Ish, because it really captures, I think, the essence of this approach to the halacha. He says, according to the Chazon Ish, what is the prohibition? Avol iser b'chukoteim lo telechu, einu ela b'mit'ave lihidamos lehem. If you like something that's fashionable, you think this is beautiful, and let's be honest, taste and fashion in general, but especially in fashion, that's all based on time and place. Culture determines all of that. So 100 years ago, if we were living in Iran, you know, growing up as a Persian Jew, you know, in the Middle East, we probably would think that certain things are fashionable, and you live in America in the 2012, you think other things are fashionable. That's okay, that's just the way what it means to be human. But if you think something is yofi hamuskam, you think this is pretty, this is what they're selling in the stores, and I went in and I think this is beautiful, I think this is fashionable, says the Chazon Ish, nothing wrong with that. But if you're doing it because you're, and this is the formulation, is so beautiful, mis'ave lihidamos lehem. It's not just that you happen to be doing something that they're doing. Mis'ave means you desire, you want to be like them. You want to be like Mike, or Mika, or whoever. That is the definition of the problem. It's not about what you wear, but why you're wearing it. And this is obviously more subtle, more difficult to judge, but I think it's very, very critical. The hour is running a little late. We have about 5-6 minutes or so. So let's try to wrap this up and give one or two more practical examples. So we have this big discussion, how do we paskin? You look at source number 17, the Ramah in Yoredeya basically combines the psak. For time purposes, I left out the Rambam and others who actually seem to be more machmir. But the bottom line is that the Ramah in his psak, which is of course what guides us today, the Ramah paskins a combination of both the Ran in source number 13 and the Maharik in number 14. He specifically gives the example of the doctor's coat. Says totally mutter. The cape, the coat, it's all fine. Because why? There's a good reason for it. It's important to know in every culture who the doctor is. But he also says, if there's something that's no reason, he's worried a little bit about Avodah Zarah. So whether it's just the issue of imitation or the fear, albeit in the culture that we're in, getting more and more secular, I think the practical issues are less and less. But still, there are things which I think, if you're living in a Christian country, which I'm sure if we knew enough, we might find religious origins, Avodah Zarah origins. So things which really make no sense, we should really try to avoid those. Either because it's imitation itself is the problem, or because we're worried about this prohibition of latent Avodah Zarah. Now just briefly to mention, we don't have time to delve into it, but you should just be aware, there is one opinion that disagrees with everything we said, and that is the Vilna Gaon. The Vilna Gaon is famous, part of the reason he is known as a Gaon, is that he had no problem arguing with people who came before him. And in this piece, he goes through the topic, he quotes the Ran, the Ma'arik, all of these tshuvas, and says they make no sense. He finds holes in everyone's theory, and therefore he says, I'm going to give my own theory. The Vilna Gaon's theory is interesting, but it's really hard to know how to apply, and that's probably why the halacha doesn't seem to follow the Vilna Gaon. He says, you know what we can't do? Something that the non-Jews thought of first, that we would never have thought of. So then you can't do it. But if the non-Jews think of something first, but you know, given a little bit more time, a little more Jewish ingenuity, we would have figured it out, then it's okay. The problem is, how do you know that? How can you figure out what we would have figured out if it wouldn't have been for them? So I'll give you just one example, which I saw, which I don't know if other poskim would agree, but there was a chief rabbi of Yerushalayim a generation or so ago, or Bezalel Zsolti, Zichrono Livracha. So he was asked a shaila towards the beginning of the establishment of the Medina, when Nebuch, there were Jewish soldiers dying in action, so they were having military funerals, whether it's on Har Herzl or other places. And the Israeli army wanted to do for these soldiers what every other army in the world does for their soldiers. And what is that? In America, we all know what this is. Right? The 12-gun salute. Other military kind of things. So Shiloh was asked for a frum soldier, you know, the army's not going to do it if the family says not to. A dati soldier, should they do that or not? And Rav Zsolti actually posited that they should not do it. You should not allow it. Why? Because he felt it went against the Vilna Gaon. He admits that if we go with the other opinions, it should be permissible. After all, you can understand why. There's a certain honor, especially for a soldier, to have that salute. But he says, what about the Vilna Gaon? The Vilna Gaon says only things we would have thought of on our own. Says Rav Zsolti, and again, I don't know if this is halacha l'maisa, and halavai it should never have to be. But I think the rationale he's giving is actually quite insightful and beautiful. He says, Jews, we know how to mourn. We know how to do death. We have a very long, beautiful, sophisticated, sensitive tradition of mourning. From the initial Goses period, through the Kriya, through the Kvura, Shiva, Shloshim, Mishnayis, Tehillim, Kaddish, Kelmole, Yizkor. We know how to remember the dead. We don't need to be borrowing Nebuch from the Goyim to figure out how to honor the dead. He says, honestly, unfortunately, at that time especially, the Jews were secular Lamahadrin. They didn't know or didn't care and didn't want to have anything to do with traditional Jewish ways of anything. So they looked to ape the British, the Americans, and they borrowed this idea of a gun. But Jews who are from the tradition, who know all the beautiful things that we have for mourning, we would never would have thought to borrow something. What we have is more beautiful. We never would have borrowed that if it would just be up to Jews sensitive to tradition. So he suggests that that would be an example where the Vilna Gaon might really come into play. Now, whether we should paskin that way, I don't know what the Rabbanut Hatzahal says now. I don't know. But it's just very interesting. I mean, again, I assume still if a family said no, then they would respect that. But what is the default position, I actually don't know. Let's end in the last 2 minutes with specific shailas that was asked to Ramosha Feinstein that is really what is most effective in impacting on all of us, which is fashion, clothing in modern America. And they asked Ramosha Feinstein whether, and this is actually more relevant to me than to you, whether a man can wear a short coat. In Europe, they were all wearing these long coats, and in America, everyone wants to wear a short coat. So is that allowed or not? Or is that, you know, the next stop in the diaspora train was America? So, chukos akum, maybe you shouldn't wear the short coat. Isn't that what happened in Mitzrayim? Didn't they keep their Jewish clothing? So Rav Moshe Feinstein has a landmark tshuva. We're going to skip again. Clearly, for those of you who are scholarly inclined and capable, I gave you far more sources which you could still look at, including an interesting idea that Rav Schechter quotes from Rav Soloveitchik in source number 23. There's a lot here, but we don't have time to go into all of that. But the bottom line is, if you combine what Rav Moshe Feinstein says both in source number 19 and what Rav Moshe Feinstein says in source 22, we have the following upshot. Moshe says two things. He says, number one, we should realize, obviously, that this halacha totally changes with time and place. Often we think of that as like a not an orthodox kind of mentality, and it could be abused, for sure. But in this halacha, says Rav Moshe, it's totally defined by time and place. We don't say, because once upon a time, this is what the non-Jews did, now Jews can never do it. Each generation, and within each generation, each location, looks around and says, what's going on? How do we relate to that? And what was usher in one generation could absolutely, says Rav Moshe, be mutter in the next generation. So first of all, he says, if nowadays everyone is wearing a short coat and the like, because it's more practical, and it's the yofi hamuskam, that's what's considered fashionable. So anyway, it should be permissible, because the Rama said that fashion is what's permissible. There's nothing wrong with that. We're allowed to be fashionable. It sounds radical, but it's in the Rishonim already, and it's certainly in Rav Moshe Feinstein and in other poskim. There's nothing wrong with being fashionable and looking nice. But then Rav Moshe adds one other chiddush, which I just find so charming. He says, in any way, In modern America, or the modern world that we live in, who's to say what's non-Jewish clothing and what's Jewish clothing? Are you really telling me, says Ramesha, we know how he looked and what life he lived, very simple, but he was a very worldly person, obviously. Says Ramesha, are you going to tell me that when they make in the great fashion houses, whether it be in America or in Paris or in Italy, when they make the next line of the season's clothing, they don't have in mind the Jews' consumers? They're only making it for the non-Jews, and this is non-Jewish clothing, and the Jew is going to come in and fight through that ghetto wall and buy the non-Jewish clothing. It's absurd, says Ramosha. When they make that clothing, they have in mind every one of you and me and every man and every Jewish woman as much as everybody else. They want someone to buy the clothing. And if you have money, they really want you to buy the clothing. So says Ramosha, when they make the suit, or they make the gown, they're making it just as much for the Jews as it's for the non-Jews. If it's not sanua and other things, you have other issues. But if something is basically modest and in good taste, so that's Jewish clothing. There's no such thing as uniquely Jewish clothing. They're making it for you. And I would add, as we all know, how many of the designers are Jewish? You know, Lauren wasn't always Lauren. So they have us in mind. We're the one making the clothing many times. What's to call this a non-Jewish suit as opposed to a bekasha, which is Jewish? Nothing. That's not my chiddush. That's what Rav Moshe Feinstein says. And we'll just end with my last word. I can't read it inside. But in source number 20, the Maharik, the one who had the revolutionary psak about the cape, he makes the profound hashkafic point, which is what's worth keeping in mind. And he says very clearly, Ein ha-Yisrael mechuyav l'hishtanos min ha-goy klal. We don't have to be different than them. Ha-ikar rak shlo yev malbush miyuchad lehem. We can't do things which are just unique to non-Jews in a way that we're just imitating them for the sake of imitating. So that has to be avoided. But things which they happen to be doing, which make sense to us, which we happen to be doing, there's nothing wrong with that. They need to be proactively different, says the Maharik. That relates to what we do, how we behave. Less important is how we dress. Not unimportant. Not that there aren't values, not that there aren't halachos. But too often, and it seems like the passing of 100 years haven't done much to change this. Too often there's too much preoccupation with how we dress and not what we're behaving. And there are halachas about both. No one should misunderstand me. There are values that govern both. But says the Maharik, more important is what you do and not just how you look. We should live and act as Jews are supposed to act. That's what's important, far more important than the clothing on our body. Thank you very much, and have a Chag Kasher V'Sameach.